Good afternoon. I'm Jeff Beckwith, the Executive Director of the Massachusetts Municipal Association, and it's the MMA's pleasure to host, have the platform hosting the regular briefings by the Lieutenant Governor and the Baker Plito administration to all of the Municipal Chief Executive Officers of Massachusetts. This is the 20th webinar briefing that the administration is providing to you, the leaders of cities and towns across Massachusetts, during the COVID-19 public health emergency. And they've filled in every hour between those sessions with more information, updates, and lots of just extraordinary work leading Massachusetts through this crisis and working and collaborating with local officials in every corner of Massachusetts. So the floor is the Lieutenant Governor's. Lieutenant Governor, we wish you and all of the local officials a happy autumn as it's coming. But as we were talking earlier, we don't really think summer is gone yet. There are many more beautiful days to come, and hopefully everyone will have a chance to enjoy those days. But Lieutenant Governor, thank you for your leadership, and the floor is yours.
Thank you so much, Jeff, and to your staff for organizing these interactions. 20 seems so many, but just think about where we were at our first meeting and how far we have all come together, working in collaboration. Your input to our administration has helped us respond better, smarter throughout this pandemic. So thank you so much for these valued exchanges of information. I think it's really benefited everyone. Just think about the virus. We went from one of the hottest states in the nation to now one of the lowest in terms of the reproduction rate of the virus. That didn't just happen. It wasn't magic. This took an extraordinary effort on behalf of the healthcare community, the frontline workers, and clearly the municipal workforce, our public servants across our Commonwealth. So just extraordinary effort. And I hope that all who are on the call are able to find some time to relax, rest, enjoy family and friends over the weekend. It was a beautiful weekend, which was very valued. I also think it was an opportunity to do what we need to do in terms of buying local, shopping local, visiting local, which was a campaign and a resource that we've made available all across our Commonwealth. Thanks in large part to you, this audience, informing our administration that we should promote this interstate support and travel. We've also been able to kind of assess the condition of the virus across our Commonwealth. You know how much we value every single community, 351 respective cities and towns, but we've also been able to work with you in describing what the virus looks like in your community and in your region. And it varies. Western part of the state and the central part where I'm from, where my family is, greener or more unshaded communities, whereas around the greater Boston area, you're seeing a set of communities that are in the redder tones and have a higher reproduction rate. I believe now we have 8 communities that are in that category. We have 49 communities in yellow, and within that yellow category, you have some trends that are seeing more transmission rate, and then you're seeing some trend downwards. So that's very valuable information. And 76 shaded green. This was meant to provide information to you as municipal leaders and school leaders with a tool to be able to make decisions, whether it's return to school, a college returning to campus, a business doing something, or family making decisions. We also want to make sure that we are providing you information, but that you're giving yourselves enough time, and maybe Dr. Madoff, who's on the call, can address some of those questions, enough time to look at data as opposed to week to week, so that you have a span of time to understand what's trending. Otherwise, there'll be a lot of bouncing around week to week, which can be more disruptive than helpful in terms of what you're trying to accomplish in your community. We are also monitoring what's happening in other places. New England, outside of Rhode Island, continues to look good with New York and New Jersey. And we added Colorado, Pennsylvania, Washington, Oregon, and Wyoming to states that do not have to be restricted in terms of the travel ban. So that's all good news. I just want to, before we get into the meat of the conversation around our schools, our learning opportunities within community, and partnering with you as municipal leaders who have been so good at taking the state guidance and then having to educate your team around further decision-making locally. We're asking a lot of you, and this is another example where we have an opportunity with guidance that your community can determine whether a learning pod or program aligned with this guidance can take place safely in your city or town. I'm sure the commissioner and the secretary will talk more about that process, what technical assistance can be available to help municipals make these decisions as efficiently as possible. Before going there, I think that you probably heard the governor's announcements last week around these more aggressive activities that can help the hotter communities, the red communities, around enforcement and intervention, you know, working with partner agencies like ABCC or the state police or MEMA, when these interventions are needed to change behavior, which doesn't happen overnight, but certainly these enforcement actions can certainly correct certain things happening that we feel are contributing to spread. And then in communities where we need to just step up the amount of communication to residents and adding a whole multilingual program around communication for mask wearing, distancing, hygiene, and all of those things that we know have been very effective to tamp down the spread of the virus. We'll continue to work specifically with the communities around what makes sense for their communities in order to address their spread, and also work directly with the communities that have a yellow color, because you want to work very hard to get that to come down and not trend into the red category. So we have resources, we have tools. We want to continue to work in collaboration with you and do what makes sense and what's smart for your community. A couple of grant announcements, which is always good news. The Community Compact IT grant program is available again. The applications open on September 15th and close on October 15th. We have $3 million in grants from municipalities and school districts. We know the value of technology and the need to update and upgrade it throughout the Commonwealth. So take advantage of these funds, awards up to $200,000 for one-time capital needs, such as technology upgrades, equipment, software, things like that. So again, September 15th, that opens. And fresh off the press, we received a communication from MEMA that the 2020 Building Resilient Infrastructure and Communities Program, also known as BRIC, is announced. These funds are available through the federal government, but are making their way to state government. And I wanted to just alert you to a webinar that will be aired on September 10th at 1 p.m. and September 11th at 10 a.m. To provide more information around this grant program, who is eligible, and see how we can utilize these funds to help our communities build resilient infrastructure. With that, I am going to turn it over I believe, to Secretary Pizer and to Commissioner Sam. As always, we have our DPH friends with us. I see Assistant Commissioner Ferguson, I see Dr. Madoff, and we have Sean Cronin from DLS, as well as my staff. So we're all hands on deck to provide you with additional information, but more so to hear from you what's going on in your communities and how we can help.
Thank you, Lieutenant Governor. Why don't I jump in? I'll provide a little bit of an overview, what's going on sort of from early ed all the way through to higher ed. I'll turn it over to the commissioner for some more detail, obviously, on the early ed side of that in particular, around some of the new regulations that were just released that have an important role for municipalities to play. And then obviously we're open for any questions and comments that you might have. It is good to see you, Jeff. Last time we spoke, you were ensconced in the woods somewhere. I don't know where. I'm glad to see you made it back to civilization. So good to see your face. Good to see you wearing a tie. I wish I could say the same. I should have gotten dressed up for this.
I only did it because of Dr. Madoff. He always wears a tie.
Yes. And I must say, it's great to see Dr. Madoff as well. He and I speak on the phone every other week, every other Friday. But I rarely get to see his face, so it's nice to see him, not in three dimensions, but at least two dimensionally. Why don't I sort of jump in again? I'll give you a brief overview of kind of where we are in the sort of pre-K through higher ed domain, and then I'll turn it over to the commissioner for some further comments. On the early ed side, we've got about 5,800 programs that are now opened or have reopened, another 150 or so that are in the process of reopening or getting their license updated. They currently enroll about 72,000 students, which represents about 60% or so of their total capacity. And currently about 40% or so of that license capacity is being utilized, which means that most programs currently have open or empty seats. Although this does vary from program to program, community to community, some of that capacity constraint may be the result of trying to meet social distancing requirements, which makes it harder for them to fully enroll their students. But nonetheless, in terms of the standing back up the capacity that had been shut down back in March when all this originally happened, there's really been tremendous progress. The field has really stepped up. There is capacity out there. There is an active effort to bring children back into early ed programs, and we're making good progress. Nevertheless, at the macro level, it does appear that we have not had a capacity problem this summer, which is good, but that doesn't mean we aren't going to have issues as we go into the fall. In particular, reopening, generally speaking, will have an impact on gradually increasing demand for childcare slots. Although many employers are planning to remain in a mostly remote mode for the foreseeable future. A recent survey of about 100 employers by the Mass Competitive Partnership indicated that about half of their workforce will continue to be fully remote even post-COVID. So we're still very much in a situation where we're trying to figure out what the new demand is gonna be, whether we're gonna have a sufficient supply to meet that demand. But there's no question that as we reopen schools, in particular, we're going to see this demand equation change, especially as schools are reopening. Many schools are reopening in remote or hybrid modes, which will put new and unexpected demands on our existing early education programs and after-school providers. Commissioner Sam will provide more details in a few minutes, especially with regard to how this will affect municipalities in terms of exempting certain untraditional organizations that are planning to step up and fill some of the gaps that are being created by remote learning plans. In K-12, as I think you're all aware, and more in many respects more so than I am, we are in a situation where every community is sort of doing their own thing based, as the Lieutenant Governor said, on the different conditions, in particular, the different categories that they may be in terms of COVID transmission. When we originally surveyed municipalities and school districts, it looked like over 80% of our districts indicated that they would be either fully or at least partially in person when school opened in this fall. That number has been dropping, mostly as a result of teachers unions resisting going back into their school buildings. And we'll have more accurate information as the week goes on, but right now it looks like about 2/3 of our districts will be in person or hybrid, which probably represents closer to half of the student populations, and some of those districts that are remote are some of the larger districts. And on any given day, the percentage of students who will actually be in classrooms is likely to be lower than that, since many students will only be in school about half the time. As you know, our general position has been that communities with relatively low rates of COVID transmission, green communities or communities with fewer than five total cases, should be working to open up their schools for in-person instruction. Communities with higher rates in the yellow zone, in particular, should be looking to hybrid solutions, while those in the red should consider going remote. Although even in those cases, districts should be making every effort to provide in-person services to their most vulnerable students. As we get ready for this new school year, Commissioner Riley has been issuing detailed guidance to schools and districts about how to reopen schools in the context of COVID. While at the same time, the governor and lieutenant governor have been allocating hundreds of millions of dollars in federal resources to directly and indirectly help schools reopen, in addition to working with the legislature to guarantee baseline Chapter 70 funding. As I think you're all aware, a recent announcement by the administration specifically allocated over $200 million in Flexible CARES Act money for COVID-related expenses associated with school reopenings. We've also allocated over $30 million to support the purchase of Chromebooks and to address connectivity issues to ensure that all children have access to essential online learning tools. We've entered into a statewide contract with two online learning platforms to enable all districts to gain affordable access to asynchronous courses, meaning courses that are being taught without live teaching, to expand online options for schools and students, and to leverage their teacher workforce, given the increasing demand on teachers to support students in multiple learning modes, in-person, hybrid, and remote. We're also putting out an RFP for higher need districts to fund full-time enrollment on these platforms or one of our two state virtual schools, which provide that sort of live teacher-led instruction, in particular focusing on medically vulnerable students. At the same time, we're expanding online dual enrollment for high school students and college courses, supplementing or expanding our existing early college programs. All of these investments in expanded remote learning capacity are complemented by the new regs I previously mentioned to create more childcare and structured learning supports during the school day for students who cannot attend at school in person. Again, Commissioner Sam will talk a little bit more about that in a minute. Separately, we're also putting out an RFP this week to provide supplementary research-based early literacy supports for younger children in high-need districts who have suffered the most from learning loss since schools closed, especially with regard to learning how to read. And finally, we've announced expanded COVID testing capacity for communities hardest hit by the virus, both in terms of an extension of the Stop the Spread program, as well as mobile rapid response testing to quickly address any potential school-based clusters in real time. On the higher ed front, as you know, most colleges are now open, although most are pursuing online learning for the majority of their classes. Many colleges are severely limiting the number of students living on campus, but others are opening up their dorms to most students who wish to live on campus. As part of the reopening process, colleges are required to have detailed plans for how they will maintain social distancing and comply with other general workplace requirements for hygiene, cleaning, disinfecting, and so on, as well as some more specific requirements for food service and special events, among others. Although we'll know in a few weeks exactly what this looks like, it looks like overall enrollment numbers are down, but not way down, even though the number of students who are present on campus is down significantly in most places. By way of example, the state colleges are expecting only about half of the number of students either living on campus or taking at least one course on campus. UMass itself is expecting much lower numbers based on its own decision to go essentially entirely online and to only invite back those students onto campus to live in the dorms who really need to be there, either because they lack adequate housing otherwise, or they may be international students, or they have some specific learning challenges that can only be addressed by being more proximate to their teachers and support system. Financially, this is likely to be a rough year for every college, although direct federal aid plus $15 million in additional aid that the governor and lieutenant governor have just released for public and private institutions serving mostly low-income students should help avoid a fiscal collapse. Having said that, depending on what happens with the virus, as well as other longer-term demographic and competitive trends, the FY22 school year, so not this year, but next year, could be very challenging from a financial point of view. So we're hardly out of the woods, even as we're just beginning this process. The bottom line is that there is obviously a lot going on across all three segments, but we are at the moment now where all that planning, all that guidance, all those resources are gonna be put into effect, and we're gonna be monitoring closely how everyone is doing at a program level, at a school level, at a higher education level. And all of those, of course, have critical implications for municipalities. And we're obviously hopefully gonna be in close and continuing communication with all of you, and would invite any of you, if there are any issues in your communities related to schools, related to education at any level, that you reach out and let us know, and that provide us with any feedback that we may need to do a better job serving you. With that, let me turn it over to Commissioner Sam to talk some more about early ed.
I have to unmute myself first, but absolutely, thank you so much. Secretary Pizer, as you were talking about in terms of what we are trying to help and solve with and address in through EEC licensed programs, before I share the exact process, I want to give you all just a glimpse into what we mean by EEC licensed programs, because we know that oftentimes early ed is thought to be birth to five. And in EEC's case, actually, we license programs that support children up to age 14. Generally, those who are enrolled in school, as you all know, are in school during the day, and our programs serve before, after school, during school vacations, and the times when children aren't in school. In this case, as districts are making different decisions about how to address the instructional time of the day, what we are doing, what we have recognized through this is that our out-of-school time programs, those programs that generally serve children who are in school during the school day and serve around the school day, are being called on more and more to help serve in virtual learning support roles that parents need as we think about the time ahead. And so as we did that, as we were recognizing this, we wanted to make sure there were pathways not only for our licensed programs to step up and make sure that they were part of the fabric your parents were going to be relying on this year, but also for those of you who have communities where there maybe aren't enough licensed programs or parents' needs go beyond what EEC is able to provide, that we are providing a pathway to partner with you to still be able to meet those needs for your families and as Secretary Pizer said, for employers who are reliant on our families to be working this year in a variety of capacities, either at home or in person, and making sure that we have supports for their children while they are being asked to do so. So in doing so, I am going to share my screen now. There we go. And I'll put it in presentation mode so that you all can do not have to read my notes along with it, hopefully. Okay. Are you able to see that? So as we've been looking at this and be thinking about how we address this, that our expanded opportunities are really about meeting the needs of those families that are working in that are working and need supports for their children during the school day, while K-12 schools may be operating in hybrid or remote learning models. So about a week and a half ago, the governor did sign an executive order that allowed us to do three separate things and wanted to outline those to you. First, traditionally our out-of-school time programs by statute have not been allowed to serve during the school day. There is actually is a strategic approach in non-COVID times. There is a statutory requirement that allows that reduces competition that has our out-of-school time programs not allowed to operate during school attendance. So the first thing that the governor's executive order did was allowed, it opened up or unlocked that part of the day for our programs. So our programs, our EEC licensed programs, of which there prior to COVID were about over 8,000 of across the Commonwealth, are now able to serve children who are attending school to be able to provide the supervision and care that a remote learning or a hybrid model may not provide for families who need this kind of support. In addition, we are able to then take that and provide some expedited licensing processes, reducing the barriers for our licensed programs to be able to partner with you at the municipal level, maybe operating in a rec center or an additional space that you have. Our licensed programs are now able to operate and have pathways that will help them be able to get that into a licensed site as quickly as possible. We also realize that our licensed programs, while we can do the best we can to try to support them, to support families and to engage with you, that we also recognize that even prior to COVID, our supply and demand for licensed providers, for licensed childcare, wasn't necessarily meeting the full swath of parents' needs. And so when we looked ahead at the year and saw a number of programs and businesses opening up to serve this need, we were seeing a market that we wanted to make sure was safe and effective and really had the right oversight for parents to be able to rely on and not put their children at risk as they're making these difficult decisions ahead. So we've come up with, in collaboration with the governor and lieutenant governor, obviously the secretary, to really think about what would be an exemption from our license process for programs that are very... that are not able to become licensed or not interested in being a licensed program long term, but looking to fill this need this year to help with the care and supervision during remote learning hours. So that role that the parents might need when children are getting instruction, but might need the oversight while they're going to work or support accordingly. So this is the exemption process we've set up so that we have an alternative pathway to businesses, to neighbors, to people who want to serve this purpose, but may not need to become licensed for long-term childcare purposes. And then finally, this executive order did also define outside of EEC's exemption or license process, adding some definition to the remote learning parent cooperatives that we know many parents are forming on their own. So we wanted to codify that and make sure that parents weren't wondering if they had to become exempt or they need to become licensed and have a real definition that they were able to utilize and know that they could operate, they could care for their children without having to worry about any of the bureaucracy during the year ahead. So as we've looked at that, the municipal role and what we're hoping to partner with municipalities is really on the exempt remote learning enrichment program. So for licensed programs, we do hope that municipalities will leverage our licensed programs, will use and partner with our licensed programs to expand capacity. In those cases, we do the background record checks, we do the facilities checks. Our licensed programs are experts at how to negotiate a day and parents' needs, how to work with schools and all of that. And so we do hope that that pathway will be the first and foremost resource for our municipalities and for all of you. And we do have, I'll talk about at the end as well, we do have some resources and some facilitation that has been offered to us through some nonprofit providers that if you are looking to get a group together with your licensed providers, that we can help facilitate some of that or deploy some facilitation to help you and support you during this time. In particular, if you don't have enough licensed providers, or if you do have a number of businesses that are looking to step up and serve for families during the school day, this is where the remote learning enrichment program comes in. I'm going to talk a little bit more about the process itself, so give me 1 second on that, but talk a little bit about what the municipality role is first and foremost. So if you don't have capacity, as I said, this is a pathway for an alternative way for a business to be able to serve this role during the school day without having to worry about going through the EEC licensing process. In order to do this, we are relying on a partnership with the municipalities that can help confirm that those programs are meeting basic health and safety checks. We are not trying to recreate a license program. We're not trying to recreate school. What we are making sure is that the adults in the program have background record checks and don't have disqualifying backgrounds. We wouldn't want them to be around children. And that we'd make sure that the facilities are safe enough to house children and a program for the year. Again, if they are a licensed program, quick pathways for them to become licensed and under EEC oversight. And this is an alternative to those that want to provide an alternative pathway. It is important to know that over the course of the year, these programs that would be applying for an exemption, in general, would under normal times be considered unlicensed childcare and be subject to the enforcement rules that EEC is charged with implementing. And so investigating it and closing any unlicensed childcare. We know that parents are relying on these services this year, and this is the importance of creating this pathway and making sure that we weren't shutting down those valuable, critical things that and resources that your parents were relying on. So I'll talk a little bit about what that looks like and what the oversight in partnership with municipalities would need to be. But I wanted to also highlight that over the course of the year, those that don't go through either of these processes would be subject to our enforcement rules as well, is a way to make sure that we can continue to provide safe resources for families and ensure that they are meeting the basic health and safety standards. So as we talk about this, what we have dubbed is a municipal approving authority process. So the important thing to keep in mind is that the municipal approving authority can be any entity at the local level that is designated by a CEO, the municipal CEO, town manager, mayor's office. And so we really are trying to leave the flexibility here that would allow for a municipality to really meet their needs and their capacity, knowing that all of you are grappling with a number of different pressures and realities on the ground. We wanted to leave it flexible, but still make sure there was the oversight. So once you have been able to designate a municipal approving authority, so someone who will take ownership of anyone who is looking to get approved, then we will ask that the municipal approving authority does coordinate to make sure that there is a site visit, the space meets appropriate standards, does the roof isn't going to fall in on children, that the background record checks are in place to make sure that that adults in the programs are safe to be with children as well. Then what we will ask is simply the program that you are approving will submit a form online with a letter and an attestation from your municipal approving authority, and provided it meets all of the criteria, that it meets the criteria, we will exempt that provider from needing a license, provide a license exemption good for the year, and expect that they will continue to engage with you in ongoing monitoring if they have a new adult that comes into the program, those kind of things, and needing a background record check. We won't ask for extensive monitoring the way EEC does. We're not asking that you go in on unannounced visits or any of those things, but to make sure that the program over the course of the year, if there are any changes, that they continue to meet those minimum standards is really our most pressing concern. We know these providers, we know these businesses are not trying to become education. And so for that reason, we're not trying to they're supplementing the education provided by a district. And so really wanted to provide the right kind of oversight, but not overly onerous for our programs. I will say on this that in doing this, many of those providers have already started to reach out. So we're eager to partner with you to understand who we might refer them to. And if you're interested in offering this kind of option for those, again, there's no pressure to offer this. This is an opportunity and trying to provide a pathway for you beyond what EEC might be able to offer in licensed providers for the course of the year. We have provided, and these resources will be available at the end of the day online, and so we'll make sure you get sent the link and everything you need for this. But you can see we've tried to make it as easy as possible in our requirements that we have easy checklists for you to fill out, making sure again that there's health guidance, that there is a facility, the facility has met fire and lead and building inspections at a minimum. If it isn't a private residence, that there are smoke alarms, because obviously that is our biggest risk for children that in private residence. And then making sure that ratio and group size are met. We have have not, we will not be, the group sizes here are really meant to be aligned with some of the COVID, with the COVID instruction from the governor and lieutenant governor around overall group sizes. And so in that, over the course of the year, this is in line with our EEC guidance. But over the course of the year, if we should see communities be able to expand, we would help you think about how to expand those spaces appropriately and within appropriate ratios as well. Again, the requirements for staffing are really background record checks and making sure that that there is a process in place that if there is a new adult or a new hire, that that person also knows that they have to get background record checked and meet minimum requirements as well. And then again, for the health and safety requirements, making sure that you have the appropriate facilities. So at here, you have this website. The website is live. The policies will be posted by the end of the day, and looking forward to engaging with you on this. And again, we'll send out this link for you to submit questions. And in here is an opportunity, if you are interested at all in being able to have a facilitator join you on the ground, talk with your licensed providers and your school district about what options might be available, how you might keep cohorts stable over the course of the year as families are relying on in-person models to supplement hybrid or remote learning, that we have a limited amount of facilitation that would be available to be deployed. And we will collect that if you're asking questions. We'll be able to prioritize based on those who are most interested in having that. I am happy to answer questions now and wanted to, again, just make sure you knew that this is an option really first and foremost to help supplement communities that may not have enough licensed childcare and overseen by EEC to make sure there are pathways for those neighbors who want to help their neighbors, for those businesses, karate studios that may not be operating in full this year that may have space to help families that are in need of in-person options, that this is the goal for this. And so very, very eager to support all of you as you grapple with the very real situations on the ground and in any way that we can.
Before we open it up for questions, thank you very much, Commissioner. Thank you, Secretary. Before we open it up for questions, Lieutenant Governor, any other words?
I thank you to the Secretary and to the Commissioner. It was a very good presentation. A lot of thought going into this. This was not a thing before the COVID hit. And it's just another example of how we've had to be flexible and creative and try to provide more resource to working families and to our students. So I'm interested to hear the feedback and see how we can support the community's efforts in finalizing these places for this learning to be supervised and take place. I've always said throughout this whole reopening process that organized, supervised activities are best, whether it's an industry sector reopening or it's getting our kids into a learning environment that's productive. It's just thank you for those efforts.
Thank you for I don't think we have any first-time audience members, but if we do, we take questions via the chat function, and then we'll go through those in order. In addition, when we send out the invitation to this to the briefing to register for the briefing and get the Zoom link, folks can also pre-ask questions, and we had a few come in that were forwarded to me just a little bit earlier. So maybe we'll start with those and then go through the ones in the chat. So the questions we had regarding education, and then there's a general public health question that we'll save for Dr. Madoff. When will DESE issue the guidance related to remote learning programs run by schools and districts, since school starting date is coming up pretty quickly?
So that guidance is already out. It was put out probably 2 weeks ago, I want to say. And there was preliminary guidance before that. So that is out there. I think there are two components to it. One is guidance around what the sort of structure and form of that remote learning should be. The other is setting some expectations in particular for structured learning time, more specifically to say that remote learning is supposed to continue to meet the same learning time requirements as in-person instruction. You know, how that gets measured and what counts and in what ways is a little bit different given the different context. But nonetheless, the expectation is that what is now 170-day school year with something on the order, I think it's 865 learning hours, is essentially the same whether you're in person or whether you're online or remote.
Thank you. A question about remote learning parent cooperatives. We haven't touched much on those, but just the issue is, if they cannot charge for anything other than materials, food, and supplies needed to support cooperative efforts, how will a non-custodial individual be employed or paid? I think this may be addressed, but the question's been asked.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's two different scenarios here. So if you are having a parent supervisor the entire time on site and they're not leaving with a non-custodial parent, then you would pay them during the school day hours, and that would be paid to as a support for children, a support for students. And so that would be allowable under the parent cooperative. If you are looking to have a non-custodial parent actually take supervising role, meaning the non-supervisory, the parent wouldn't be there, that actually does look a lot like our family child care process and family child care systems, which is why we've set up these two alternatives. So one, an expedited licensing process that they can come in and become a licensed family child care, or two, an approval process where they'd be able to provide this in a non-support way, a non-parental support way through the municipal approval process.
And do you recommend a certain department for the municipal CEO to designate, even if you don't require or mandate? Board of Health, Recreation, School Department, for example, is there, there's broad flexibility. Do you have any preferences?
Yeah, you know, honestly, happy to work with municipalities to choose the most appropriate entity. And this is largely going to depend, and to say, it doesn't only have to be one entity either. This can be a coordination across multiple entities. For example, background record checks could be done by one entity and the facility checks by another, as long as we have one person that we know is going to sign off that all of that has been completed and it's being coordinated at the municipal level. We want to look at in this process, we want to look at who has capacity, who has the ability to do this, but also who has the authority to run background record checks, for example. And what you'll find there is police departments, school districts, many entities at the local level do have. And so this is going to really depend on what the configuration of the municipal authorities really are at the local level, and we're happy to work through. We don't have a preference ourselves.
And then question about costs, and I'll expand the question for both sides. So the first question is, are there restrictions on costs that can be charged to families at these sites?
We have not put policies in place that would restrict the cost for families. I know many municipalities have worked with these providers as well as our licensed providers to try to defray the cost for families, knowing that they're using it to supplement education hours. But we don't have any specific guidance on that. If, again, this is an area where we can help problem solve at the local level if there is a specific question that we can help work with.
And how about for municipalities? For example, the cost of the Cori and Sori checks the cost of going through that process, can they charge these remote learning enrichment entities for those costs?
Absolutely. We have not put any prohibition on any charging for the remote learning program. So in terms of background record check costs that might be incurred, absolutely, that could be put with the remote learning enrichment program, as well as any sort of time and energy costs. I will say again, for our license programs and an effort to try to help you not put all of it on municipalities, but really help you expedite work with our license program, programs. We've also defrayed all the licensing costs for our licensed programs this year. So if there is any charge or something, we've been able to defer that for the year so that they can be the best partners and not have any barriers in the way of working with municipalities to solve these issues as well.
We have a question here from a community. It says that we have a provider that has leased empty space, warehouse space, and are well into a local process, and then the executive order was issued. Parents had already signed up for opening next week after the planning board has a hearing related to parking and signage and so on. So now does this community need to back into the back up and go through the formal process that you've just described? And the question is, will EEC actually inspect the site? It sounds like not. That's a municipal responsibility.
Yeah. So this is, and again, happy to take this offline and deal with some real problem solving. We know that that municipalities are dealing with real-time issues as well, so we want to be as supportive as possible. If it's a licensed provider who's working in that warehouse, we absolutely would inspect it, and we'd work with them and make sure. I don't know of this issue, so I don't think it's our licensed provider. And then if it's not a licensed provider, we can help you, again, not trying to make you backtrack and reverse for parents so much as just add that layer of protection to make sure that adults are background record checked and facilities checks are happening. And if those things are happening, we can make sure that we get it in the right format for our exemption, and that's not a problem at all.
And then another community says, our municipal parks and recreation departments considering running a remote learning enrichment program. Do the relevant orders and guidance permit a municipal department to operate such a program? Does the municipality need to go through this process?
The municipality would need to go through this process if you were going to provide childcare during remote learning hours. Again, if you're running it yourself, it might be even easier. You might already have the background record checks and you're just attesting that, yes, we've done it. That will prevent us from engaging with any investigation on unlicensed care should it get reported to us from any reporter.
Great. And then... would hiring additional Board of Health or the municipal approval staff be eligible for CARES Act reimbursement? And our Board of Health is already overburdened. So if they have to hire someone to go through that process, even if it's part-time or something like that, Sean, do you think that would be CARES Act eligible?
Yes, just remember that it needs to be spent, expenses incurred by December 30th. So any point after that under the current rules would not be reimbursable. But yes.
Okay. And let me thank you very much. I'm going to go through and see. This is an education-related question. Is there any concern or provisions made for a significant drop in enrollment in October? Our community is looking at an expected drop of 250 students. Which could possibly translate to millions. I guess that's referring to lost aid.
So just, and I think you're all aware of this, the October count will be relevant for the FY22 budget. So in calculating Chapter 70 and other things, that's the number that we're going to be using. So it won't have any immediate impact on the current school year. We are obviously going to take a close look at those numbers. We've heard these concerns expressed before. And we'll, you know, as we go into the preparation of the FY22 budget, we'll have to sort of make some judgment call around how significant an impact that is, to what extent it's kind of across the board, or whether it's concentrated in just a few communities. But I think it's an important issue. We need to pay attention to it as we develop the budget. And I can, you know, certainly commit that we're going to be looking at that closely once the numbers come in this fall.
Thank you. A couple of finance questions, and then we'll go to the general public health questions. This has to do with CARES Act reporting requirements. Has ANF released CARES Act reporting requirements? If so, where can we find those given a 9/25 deadline? And then a related question is whether or not there's any movement on the December 30th deadline being extended by the federal government.
Well, I'll handle the first part, and Jeff, you could probably answer the second part better than I can. First part is yes. Actually, probably about a half hour ago, I'm going to copy and paste the link. And then now, I will send it out to everybody. It's up on our website right now, the template, and ANF The Federal Funds Office will be sending out a basically a set of directions to the municipal CFO or equivalent, so that he or she will be able to do the reporting requirement. So that's live now. And then the second part, Jeff, I defer to you.
Sure. Thanks, Sean. The question about any movement on the December 30th deadline being extended refers to the requirement or the limitation in the CARES Act itself, that CARES Act funds be used to reimburse for COVID-19 related expenses that occur up until December 30th. The HEROES Act that the House passed in May, the U.S. House passed in May, would extend the use of the funds. It's now up to the U.S. Senate to come up with its own version of legislation to provide further COVID-19 relief and support to states, municipalities, those on unemployment, and so on. But unfortunately, the Senate is bogged down and is unable to generate a consensus piece of legislation at this time. Negotiations are not going well between the administration, the Democratic members, and Republican members in the Senate. In fact, there's been very little direct discussion between the White House and the Senate Republican majority in the Senate on the bill. Speculation is that maybe something will happen within the next 2 weeks or so in terms of ratcheting up at least a bill that can be the basis of negotiations. But right now, everything is stalled, and that means we just get closer and closer to the December 30th deadline without an actual extension and the surety that you'd be able to use CARES Act funds for expenses in January and beyond. Let me just see, that right there covers all of the specific questions for Secretary Pizer and Commissioner Sam. So we're going to take some general questions that either Lieutenant Governor or Dr. Madoff or Assistant Commissioner Ferguson might want to take. The first, I'll just go right to this one. It was asked by the president of the MMA, so I'll make sure it gets asked during this. She had forwarded a question and just said, is it possible to give us some guidance about the timeline for once a vaccine is actually available? How much time might that take before we go into that new normal stage 4 and we get back to where all businesses can return, people can return to offices and so on? Do you have a sense of how much time that would take?
Well, let me just say overall, the strategy around containing the virus is obvious. We know where we're at right now. And we also have to balance the public health with the economic health of the Commonwealth. So there are things that we can look toward. First of all, looking closely at what reopening looks like in the Commonwealth. Some places in Western Mass have very little virus, we talked about that earlier. And then there are some communities that have a rate of spread that we're trying to contain. So they're looking at other states that have allowed for certain activities to take place in regions that have less virus is something that we will explore more deeply. We can also look at what reopening looks like. There's step 2 of phase 3 that has not been activated. Is there something that can be activated there? There's also the gathering order and the capacity limits relative to activities across the board. All of that is under evaluation, and we will look at our public health data as we have throughout this process to determine when these activities can be eligible for opening further or opening to begin with. The other piece is we've worked so hard, all of us, in getting kids back to school, getting kids onto college campuses. This has been a major effort since we announced the start of phase 3, which was in July. So that doesn't give you a specific, but in a very uncertain world, that gives you a sense of how we're looking at this. In addition to reopening, we're also looking at resources. Maybe federal funds will become available to the states that we can deploy to help small businesses and help community and neighborhood and downtown development, and looking at the resources that we have within state government that are authorized but unexpended, how can we look at these resources to help further support industry sectors hardest hit? The hospitality industry is an example. And then the guidances that we put out, we are hearing from, say, restaurants that are concerned about weather changing. You know, we've seen the success due to a lot of efforts of the municipalities of this outdoor dining. And we've had pretty good weather to get more people to enjoy that experience. But we also have guidance around indoor dining. And, you know, how do we get more people to feel comfortable dining in and migrating into those spaces, as well as, is there something more we can do with the guidance to relieve some of the costs on restaurants and open up even more seating inside? So all of those kinds of things are being evaluated as we again balance both more economic activity and the public health data as it comes to us.
Lieutenant Governor, I think you've answered one of the later questions just right there. So thank you very much as well. So you
don't know if Dr. Madoff has anything. You have your crystal ball. You could tell us about the vaccine.
I wish. You know, we're all chomping at the bit, you know, hoping and looking forward to a safe and effective vaccine. And you know that we're working as hard as we can towards rolling that out in a safe, effective way. It will take time, and it's really hard to predict how that's going to unfold.
There's also more developments with treatment, and of course, more rapid, less costly surveillance testing. So those are all things that didn't really we did not have available to us at the beginning of this pandemic response, but are more available to us now.
Oh, everything's all related. Everything's all connected. And the work that the Commonwealth has done has positioned us to be at least that much closer to fulfilling the transition to life back to the new normal. There is a question regarding the metrics that are used, the green, yellow, red mapping. A community is concerned, it's a smaller community of under 20,000, saying if they just have two cases a day, on average, they'll eternally be in the red. And just wondering about the use just of positive cases in the community when their number of active cases is actually way down compared to where it was in July. So if you could just explain a little bit more for the communities that are especially smaller and could see some volatility and some challenges with the rating system?
Yes, we should probably look at that more closely. I'd like Dr. Madoff and the Assistant Commissioner to comment if they'd like. But the cases per 100,000 has been a metric that is widely used, of course, here in the Commonwealth, but in other places. And that's primarily what we're using as a way to measure what's taking place in a community. But if there's more analysis that needs to be done in this particular community, that is a possibility. And Doctor, I don't know if you have something to add to that.
Right, I would just say that we look at a 14-day rolling average. So it does help even out some of the, you know, day-to-day, even week-to-week fluctuation, which we know happens. And also in smaller communities, if there are fewer than a certain number of cases, those communities are listed, are not given a color on the map or a rate that are considered low risk in general. So even if the number is very low and the rate is low in that community, it would also be counted as low risk.
Very good. Thank you.
In this case, 20,000 might not be small enough. Right. So there right. might be something that we need to take right. a look right. at more closely there, and we will do that. We'll follow up with you, Jeff, to understand that issue more.
Great. Thank you very much. I do have one final question. There are no other. We've covered all of the questions, which is great because we're just now at 1 hour for the briefing, and so we'll be respectful of everyone's time. did want to note that the in the order and the guidance that you have provided to communities in their role for the remote learning enrichment programs, that you don't place a limitation on what communities can look for as requirements to be able to operate. So, for example, communities may be concerned to make sure that it's a going enterprise that has adequate insurance, for example, and adequate ability to actually remain a going concern. So there are some other areas that communities over time may be asking questions or exploring. And so it'll be important to also catch that information too, because I think that could also come up in a health, the FAQs that you publish and so on could share some practices that communities develop as this process unfolds. But you've created a process that's permissive of communities and provides flexibility, and we appreciate that very much for the framework. And just in terms of the follow-up, just to remind everyone, these briefings are now going to be held in general about every 2 weeks. The next briefing is scheduled for September 22nd at 1 p.m. And we look forward to the updates, the information sharing, which is so critical and helpful, that the MMA will post a summary of this article, the audio of this webinar and this briefing, an audio recording so those who miss it can catch it. We'll also post the PowerPoint presentation that's given and the links that have been provided by Commissioner Sam, also by Sean Cronin. Also, we're going to try and find the information on the September 10th webinar or the two webinars regarding the BRIC grant funding, in case communities don't have those, we can connect to that as well. And we'll follow up. I don't think there are any unanswered questions, except that there are other areas that are unfolding, and we'll continue to work with you, Lieutenant Governor, and your team to provide real-time updates between these briefings to our members. Any final words for all of us?
Thank you every day. Your creativity, your flexibility, your hard work, it's extraordinary. Thank you very much for the exchange today. It was very helpful.
And I think our members would say right back at you, Lieutenant Governor. Everyone respects all of the work that you and your team are doing. And we thank you, and we look forward to this continuing process as we pass Labor Day. We hope everyone is safe and is able to relax a bit and enjoy the good weather while it lasts. We look forward to working in partnership with you, and we look forward to seeing you on September 22nd at the next briefing. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Have a good night.